Stop thinking that you're special, baby boy, you're fortunate. An orphan of style, an orphan's lost inside of what occurs. Looking up the curb between a jig with pigs and angry birds. Came in like a lamb, going out just like a black lion, yet a panther. I confess it, I'm conspiring on a better way. I'll be the flame of a better day. And it's a bet I raise, better yet, I better amaze. But it's a different day. No platform for old men. You know him, be known as he who goes in. Check it out. Said I blow the you buy a better deal. And there could be no better view than when I bid you adieu. Things unchanged. We let the blind lead the way. It's the season. Everybody got a reason to pray. A humdrum paradise rut. I demand your slice cut. Assholes ain't playing a role. They be straight butt. Quick to grandstand like they came with a new walk. Every city's the bomb, but the fuel cell. New York, technique sublime. My rhyme style divine. So yeah, we can all share, but what's yours is mine. Yeah, we can all share, but no, I own this here. And I'll raise the glass. But I'm in the cup holding a golden spear. Yeah, we can all share, but no, I own this here. Say we can all share, but no, I own this here. And amidst the storm should come the sound come clear. Everyone around the world, when you hear the crowd cheer. Yeah, we can all share, but no, I own this here. So I done sniffed a little something, but there's more to smell. Body the mic, the witnesses, they all can tell. I don't give a cell, homie, I'll be here to heat the heat. I rep the spark in the dark, under the moon on Candle Street. I say I play with the word. Truck on the curb, and where I used to say fuck, now it's plus what you heard. If you ain't trying to make it better, then I can't relate. Now I ain't doing good, family, I'm doing great. For breakfast, the B-boys beat and breakfast, and every day's an opportunity for greatness. I rock the body threat, yeah, you can make a hearty bet that you can't deny. Fly enough to make the party sweat. Say I rep the obvious, I'm everything they're not. Even looking at y'all funny, cause y'all thought that shit was hot. Not that the sky fell in, but it's telling. The most beautiful here. And I'll raise the glass to those that blow this year. But I'm in the cut holding the golden spear. Yeah, we can all share, but no, I own this here. Say we can all share, but no, I own this here. And amidst the storm should come the sound come clear. Everyone around the world, when you hear the crowd cheer. Yeah, we can all share, but no, I own this here.
Party. It's going to be awesome.
Music Waste and CITR 101.9 are pleased to present the 10th annual Victory Square Block Party on August 31st.
Ooh, yeah!
This free day of music features the Shilohs, Cool, Dead Soft, Tough Age, Supermoon, Purple Hearts Social Club, Nervous Talk, and Fountain, plus DJs Cherche La Femme and Richard McFarlane. Come down to Victory Square from 2 to 9 p.m., located on the corner of Canby Street and West Hastings.
Can do!
For more information, go to victorysquareblockparty.com.
Your tender roads are tasked ahead. Double back to cover the tracks again. Again.
Whoever said money can't buy you friends obviously wasn't a member at CITR. When you become a member, you get the Friends of CITR card with incredible discounts in the UBC and Kitsilano area at
Australian Boot Company, Banyan Books and Sound, The Bike Kitchen, The Cove, Dantry's Pub, Displace Hashery, Limelight Video, The Eatery, Fresh's Best Salsa, Gargoyle's Bar and Grill, Lotus Land Tattoo, Nuba Kitsilano, Prussian Music, Rufus's Guitar Shop, and the UBC Bookstore.
To find out more, visit us in room 233 of the sub on the UBC campus or go online to citr.ca.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taking to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
August issue of Discorder is here. Be sure to pick up a copy around town or check it out online at discorder.ca and catch features on Pat Locke, Dirty Spells, Horses Records, The Beelines, and so much more. Also be sure to peep the Discorder playlist, now available through SoundCloud. And a very special thank you to this issue's advertisers, Audiopile Records.
Today is Friday, the 22nd of August. I'm Marco.
And I'm Rohit Joseph. You're listening to CITR News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from the University of British Columbia, to our UBC campus, to the residents of Vancouver, and to listeners of our newscast and podcast on our website, citr.ca.
Good evening. It's 5:10. And time for a full hour of independent campus, local and international news.
All this plus your weekend weather forecast brought to you by Environment Canada.
Today's top stories are segments. Our segment one, our science and technology correspondent Marco, which is me. Discussion of the week's top science findings.
We also have an interview with Andrew Parr, the Managing Director of Student Housing and Hospitality Services at UBC, who discussed how student housing works and the looming student housing shortage. But first, some headlines for today. In campus news, new UBC doctoral and postdoctoral researchers impress federal agencies. 32 UBC doctoral students were awarded Vanier Canada graduate scholarships, allowing them to continue research in fields from music therapy to genomics, with each researcher receiving $50,000 a year for 3 years. The total number of Vanier Canada graduate scholarships for this year was 166. In addition, the Banting Postdoctoral Fellowship Program recognized 6 UBC postdoctoral researchers, awarding each winner $140,000 over 2 years. Funding both awards totaled more than $34 million for this year, with the young UBC researchers receiving $5.7 million. The announcements were made by Minister of State Science and Technology Ed Holder and Leader of the Government in the House of Commons Peter Van Loan.
In local news, BC Ferries proves profitable following government cuts and service reduction. Earlier today, BC Ferries released its earnings from this fiscal year's first quarter. From April to June 2014, the corporation showed net earnings of $13.9 million. Compared to last year's $4.3 million, the earnings have more than tripled for the same three-month period. This spike in profits has been attributed to higher fares, transportation fees, and fuel surcharges, coupled with the newly lowered financing costs. BC Ferries representatives remain cautious, saying their gains were offset by lower traffic levels and a 2% jump in operating costs. Ferries President Mike Corrigan said that their catering and retail sectors are part of the net earnings increase, as well as a 6.6% rise in revenue. BC Ferries' financial success follows cuts to the corporation's funding earlier this year. In March, Provincial Transportation Minister Todd Stone was adamant that the service reduction would be beneficial to British Columbians. Quote, "What we're trying to balance here is the taxpayers of British Columbia cannot afford to subsidize $2,500 per vehicle," the minister said. Quote, "That's a higher amount, and we're moving forward with the changes we've proposed. These cuts were largely to less popular services and routes to Aboriginal tourism destinations, including the route from Bella Bella to Bella Coola, where the active ferry was replaced by a refitted barge. The cuts certainly seem to improve the corporation's bottom line, but it will remain to be seen how the profitability of BC Ferries will help its passengers.
Federal regulators approved proposals to turn BC's Lower Mainland into one of North America's coal export centers. Yesterday, the Fraser Surrey Docks were officially granted permission to build a coal transfer facility along the Fraser River. The new facility will transfer 4 million tons of U.S. thermal coal from trains to barges bound for a deep-sea terminal of Texada Island before going on to Asian markets across the Pacific. The approval follows 2 years of concerted efforts by activists to oppose the project due to concerns about climate change as well as possible health risks of coal dust and diesel exhaust. Despite the official approval, Port Metro Vancouver's Vice President of Planning and Operations, Peter Zada, issued a statement saying that the Fraser Surrey Docks will still need to, quote, meet a strict set of conditions when it comes to safety and environmental standards. Mr. Zada added that, quote, through our comprehensive project reviews process, stakeholder consultation as well as third-party validated environmental and health studies, it was determined that there are no unacceptable risks and the project could be permitted. Concerns about the facility were raised by many, including the chief medical health officers of the Vancouver Coastal Health Authority, as well as the cities of New Westminster, Burnaby, and Vancouver. In response, Port Metro Vancouver mandated an environmental impact assessment, despite not being obligated to do so by the provincial or federal governments. The agency predicted that the $15 million facility will boost employment by offering 25 direct and 25 indirect full-time jobs. The Texada Island side of the plans are being legally challenged, and activists have vowed to take the matter to regional air quality regulators. A spokesman from the organization Voters Taking Action on Climate Change said that, quote, the fight isn't over yet.
In national news, Canadian national anthem up for revisions once again. A Toronto city councillor wants to change the lyrics of Canada's national anthem to include more gender-neutral language. Councillor Sita Ram Katilawan Singh will propose a motion at Monday's Toronto Council meeting to change the lines from All in Thy Son's Command to In All of Us Command. Her proposal is an endorsement of the Sing All Us campaign, which has recently gained popularity and whose supporters include famous author Margaret Atwood. Some at Toronto City Hall, including Mayor Rob Ford, are questioning whether the motion should come before council at all, since it is a federal issue and the city has no power over the anthem. Councillor Rama Kalawan Singh said today, quote, the national anthem is an important symbol in Canada. We should all be represented in it. It's a very small change.
And in international news, Ukraine-Russia tensions mount as convoy crosses border. Today, more than 100 Russian trucks were sent across the violence-torn border in what Moscow said was a mission to deliver the humanitarian aid. The Ukrainian government denounced the convoy as, quote, direct invasion, and NATO, as well as the United States, were quick to follow suit. NATO has also recently announced that it has mounting evidence that Russian forces are operating inside Ukraine and launching artillery strikes from within the country. The convoy entered Ukraine without government permission after being held up at the border for a week, and fears that the mission was a ploy to supply pro-Russian separatists in eastern Ukraine. Russian ambassadors to the UN addressed those fears, saying, quote, we discussed providing humanitarian aid. This is what Russia is doing. The United States does not have a monopoly on humanism. While Russia maintains that there was, quote, ample possibility for double-checking on the convoy, the White House National Security Council reported that the convoy was compromised of, quote, Russian military vehicles painted to look like civilian trucks, and that, quote, while a small number of these vehicles were inspected by Ukrainian customs officials, most of the vehicles have not been inspected by anyone but Russia.
Those are your campus local, national, and international headlines on News 101. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned.
I went to residential school. I was just 8 years old.
Gayla Kasla. My name is Gennarji O'Sullivan of the Tlaalitsis Nation, originally from Turner Island. You're listening to Wendell exploring the legacy of Indian residential schools.
This PSA was cut from a rally called Honor the Apology in Ottawa, Ontario. Those speaking are Clayton Thomas Mueller, Melody McIver, and Jocelyn Ayatoll.
Today, across this country they call Canada, is a day where we're asking for truth to come to the surface so that we can actually begin a conversation about reconciliation. Today, Canadians, newcomers, First Nations, Métis, and Inuit peoples from all walks of life and religious denominations will reflect upon the impacts of Canada's residential schools.
The burden of this experience has been on your shoulders for far too long. The burden is properly ours as a government and as a country. There is no place in Canada for the attitudes that inspired the Indian residential school system to ever again prevail. You have been working on recovering from this experience for a long time, and in a very real sense, we are now joining you on this journey. That was Stephen Harper in 2008. Unfortunately, the burden of this experience has not been shared. We believe it is time for us to all face what happened during one of the most violent policies in this country's history. We believe it is time to take a journey of honesty together.
We now know that there is tangible violations of the Geneva Code on Genocide.
Whoever said money can't buy you friends obviously wasn't a member at CITR. When you become a member, you get the Friends of CITR card with incredible discounts in the UBC and Kitsilano area at
Australian Boot Company, Banyan Books and Sound, The Bike Kitchen, The Cove, Dantry's Pub, Displace Hashery, Limelight Video, The Eatery, Fresh's Best Salsa, Gargoyle's Bar and Grill, Lotus Land Tattoo, Nuba Kitsilano, Prussian Music, Rufus's Guitar Shop, and the UBC Bookstore.
To find out more, visit us in room 233 of the sub on the UBC campus or go online to citr.ca.
Welcome back to News 101. You are listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca, broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us.
Up next, we have our weekly science and technology segment with Marco.
Good evening, people. This is this week's science and technology segment. First, we're going to start with technology news. In this headline, it reads, Apple bans chemicals that cause nerve damage. Apple has just banned two toxic chemicals, benzene and n-hexane, from the manufacturing process of its computers and other products. In previous efforts, Apple has developed power cords without PVC, displays without mercury, and enclosures without brominated flame retardants. But now, after 2 years of controversy surrounding the treatment of its factory workers, Apple's Lisa Jackson, the vice president of environmental initiative and at Apple, announced Thursday that Apple will eliminate the use of benzene and n-hexane in the assembly of its electronics. Benzene is a carcinogenic associated with the cause of leukemia. And n-hexane, workers who are exposed to high concentrations of this chemical, n-hexane, in large doses can develop nerve damage, according to the U.S. Center for Disease Control. Lisa Jackson, the vice president, was quoted as saying, Apple had recently received some questions about whether chemicals were being used at Apple. So we dispatched investigators into 22 factories and found that no evidence of workers' health was being put at risk. But still, Apple decided to phase out the use of unsafe chemicals like benzene and n-hexane. And this has been updated to make sure that the two chemicals are not used in any of its manufacturing processes or in any of its manufacturing plants. In other high-tech news, well, everybody has heard of smartphones, but now get ready for smart shoes. Yes, the headline reads, Walk This Way, Smart Shoes Lead the Way for the Blind. Burying one's nose in a phone trying to cipher directions could be over. An Indian company called Ducer Tech, a tech startup, has created smart shoes called Lecho that can give the wearer directions without needing to look at a smartphone. The word Lecho translates to take me there in Hindi. In using the smart shoe, the user has to enter the destination into the Lecho app using Google Maps or a similar navigation map app. From this point on, the user no longer needs to look at their phone. The app connects via Bluetooth to a module that slides into the back of the shoe. Then, when the person is walking, the user is walking, the right or left shoe will buzz and give a tingling sensation depending on which direction the user should turn. Crispian Lawrence and Anirudh Sharm developed the device in India primarily as an improvement to walking and navigational aids for the blind. Quote, the white cane, while an effective aid, falls short with respect to navigation, directions, and orientation, So says Anirudh Sharm. Moreover, current assistant devices rely primarily on providing audio feedback. In addition to providing directions, the shoe also tracks steps taken and calories burned. For those people who don't want to give up using their favorite pair of sneakers, the same technology is available in an insole platform where the insole can be inserted into the shoe. The shoes are available in red or black, and they retail for $150. The insoles will retail for $100. The app is compatible with Android, iOS, and Windows. The entire package can be pre-ordered on the product's website, with the first batch shipping out in March. Again, the name of the company is Ducere Tech, so D-U-C-E-R-E. Tech. In other news, UBC figured prominently in last week's SIGGRAPH conference. Last week's SIGGRAPH conference brought together the leading professionals in the computer industry for a five-day conference in the Vancouver Convention Center. In the conference, UBC computer scientists unveiled a new design graphic system that has the potential to dramatically simplify how designers, architects, and artists develop new product ideas. Previously, converting an idea into a 3D model using current commercial tools was a complicated and painstaking process. UBC researchers developed the True-to-Form app, a software algorithm inspired by the work of professional designers, which effectively communicates ideas through simple drawings. Alice Scheffer, a professor in UBC's Department of Computer Science, said, and quote, "Inline drawings, designers and artists, and the use of descriptive curves and informative viewpoints to convey the full shape of an object is what our algorithm does. Our system mimics the results of human three-dimensional shape inference to lift a sketch curve network into 3D. The true-to-form algorithm uses powerful mathematics to interpret artist strokes automatically, lifting drawings off the page. It produces convincing complex 3D shapes computed from individual sketches." And now, in the next story, we all know that criminals on parole must wear ankle bracelets to monitor their whereabouts, or some of them do. But now, babies are doing the same. Yes, our two-year-old babies are now wearing ankle bracelets, but not because they are doing anything wrong. It is because of sleep-deprived parents. The sleep-deprived parents who struggle to make sense of their baby's behavior are starting to take a scientific approach, collecting data in the hopes of solving problems like not being able to sleep through the night. The ankle monitor is not associated with criminal behavior or house arrest, but the Sproutling baby ankle monitor tracks vitals in the baby, such as heart rate, body temperature, and it can tell if the baby is moving or is in a dangerous face-down position. The environmental sensor in the bracelet picks up on the humidity, noise level, and temperature of the baby's room. Best of all, it learns about each child's behaviors over time and adjusts accordingly. For example, it might deduce that the optimal room temperature for sleeping for the baby, and it can also deduce the child's nap patterns and point out that, for example, lowering the temperature by 2 degrees will help the baby sleep better. Or it can sense elevated noise levels and could warn parents that their child is going to wake up unless it's quieter. The manufacturer of the baby ankle bracelet, Sproutling, it has made it out of a soft fabric that is machine washable. The ankle bracelet can be pre-ordered for $250, and it will ship out in March of next year. But Sproutling's ankle bracelet is not the first wearable baby monitor on the market. A company called MIMO makes, yes, that's MIMO, M-I-M-O, makes a $200 onesie with a detachable monitor that tracks heart rate, skin temperature, moving, and sleep patterns. Another company called Owlet manufactures a monitor that straps to the ankle and sends text alert. Sproutling has set itself apart by returning insights instead of just data. For example, the monitor learns patterns in the child's behavior and then gives tips, insight, and advice to parents based on data for each specific child. The company is confident that the baby monitor will stand out when it's released, and it now has four more products in the pipeline for use with older kids and the rest of the family. In environmental news, a new study has said that from the years 1991 to 2010, 69% of the glacier melt worldwide has been caused mainly by humans. The Artesonraju Glacier in Peru is among one of the 200,000 glaciers around Earth that were tracked in the study. The study concluded that human emissions counted for approximately 69% of the loss of ice from glaciers from 1991 to 2010. Man-made greenhouse gases have become the dominant cause of melting in glaciers from the Alps to the Andes that is now raising world sea levels, and this is all due to an increase in global temperatures. Human emissions have accounted for 69% of the loss from glacier, meaning that 31% of the loss is due to natural causes. But human causes have now become the dominant cause of glacial loss. The study used historical observations dating back decades before on observations of glaciers around the world, except in the Antarctic, because much of the glacial loss in the Antarctic is from glaciers slipping into the sea. Many glaciers grew during a period called the Little Ice Age, which lasted from 1350 to 1850. And this was perhaps due to a cause in the natural decline in the sun's output or sun-dimming volcanic eruptions. Some warming naturally followed that period, but it is human factors that have caused the majority of glacial loss in the past 20 years. One of the authors of the study, Professor Zemp, said that greenhouse gases already in the atmosphere mean that glacial retreat and related sea level rises will continue for decades, even if emissions were to stop now. Retreating glaciers are a concern for many reasons. For instance, one, the Himalayas, which supply vital water to millions of people, are usually replenished by snowfall on the glacier in the winter. As they retreat, the water source could dry up for good. Number two, another cause for concern is melting glaciers can also pose an additional problem. The meltwater sometimes pooled into dam lakes, and when these dam lakes give way, they may generate devastating landslides and floods that can wipe out entire villages. The research is in something called the Randolph Glacier Inventory for anybody that wants to look at it. In other environmental news, the snow cover on the Arctic ice sheet has thinned 30 to 50%. Researchers from NASA and from the University of Washington in Seattle confirmed that springtime snow on the sea ice in the Arctic has thinned significantly in the last 50 years, by about a third in the Western Hemisphere and by half near Alaska. The new study, published this month in the Journal of Geophysical Research, tracks changes in snow depth over decades. It combines data from NASA's Bromide Ozone and Mercury Experiment, BROMEX, and NASA's Operation Icebridge flights, and instrumented buoys and ice floes staffed by Soviet scientists from the 1950s through the 1990s. I spoke with one of the researchers, Melinda Webster, and we will have an interview next week on her findings. She twice went up to the Arctic to study this Arctic sea ice and the snow cover, and she related to me how the polar bears in the region came over and seemed to take interest in their study. Son Naim of NASA's JPL in Pasadena said, and quote, "The snow cover is like a shield that can insulate sea ice, but the snow cover has become so thin that his shield has become a veil. This has led to warmer waters in the Arctic, and the organisms like plankton in the bottom of the food chain cannot survive in those warmer seas, and this will threaten the whole food chain since the plankton form the lower parts of the food chain. What thinner snow cover will mean for the ice will be further studied, and we will have an interview next week with Melinda Webster, an oceanography graduate student at the University of Washington. For more information, visit www.washington.edu. Sorry, but this is going to be long. /2014/08/13/snow-has-thin-on-arctic-sea-ice. Whew, that was a long one. And in our final story, Hello Kitty is in space and wants your messages. Yes, the lovable cat from Japan is now in space, and so she is now a castronaut. Hello Kitty was sent into space and is orbiting the Earth now in a small satellite, and she is now ready to beam messages from space for Fan and to accept messages from Fan. Images from Sanrio Company Limited, the company responsible for the cute pop culture cat, shows Hello Kitty in space clutching a toy while showing stunning views of Earth in a small window in the background. The Earth views are real, with Sanrio launching Hello Kitty as a passenger on the small nano-satellite Hodoyoshi 3 in June. A digital display sits above the window to show messages from Earth. Hello Kitty is standing by to deliver your messages from space, reads a message on Sanrio posted on the website. The mission is part of Sanrio's 40th anniversary celebration for Hello Kitty. Sanrio has started taking submissions for thank you messages to Hello Kitty in space, and messages can be 180 characters long in Japanese or English, but only 10 messages will make it to space. For the project, Sanrio sent a 1.6 inch or 4 centimeter Hello Kitty doll aboard the Hodoyoshi 3 spacecraft, one of two satellites. Hodoyoshi 4 is one of the others, built by the University of Tokyo's Nano Satellite Center. The figure is riding in a compartment about 28 inches tall and about 20 inches wide and deep, according to a Sanrio statement. Hodoyoshi 3 launched from Russia on June 19th, along 36 other satellites. It costs a lot to send these satellites into space, so Sanrio must have paid a lot to send this little Hello Kitty figure into space. The spacecraft's primary mission, though, is to test space technology and snap high-resolution photos of Earth from space. According to Reuters, the Hodoyoshi 3 satellite is about the size of a trash can and is part of a larger $40 million project by Japan's Education and Science Ministry to promote interest in science and technology. This is your science and technology news from Marco. Have a nice weekend.
Thank you, Marco. We're going to take a
quick PSA break, but stay tuned for more contributor segments right here on CITR 101.9 FM.
evening extravaganza of digital proportions. Don't miss Patterns, Locomoto Art's annual multimedia interactive art exhibit and public event. 8:30 to 11:30 p.m. August 24th at Aberthaw Mansion. Come see where nature meets the latest in new media, digital arts, audio, and technology. Free and great for all ages. You can also join in on free workshops taking place all of August. For all event info, go to locomotoart.weebly.com.
Welcome back to News 101. You are listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca, broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us.
We now have your local weather forecast for the weekend brought to you by Environment Canada. All right, so tonight is going to look a bit cloudy, just a few clouds with a low of 15 degrees. And on Saturday, we're in luck. It's going to be sunny with a little mix of sun and cloud in the afternoon. High of 23 degrees, except 27 degrees if you're inland. The UV index is 6 or high, so make sure to put on some sunscreen. And then Saturday night is partly cloudy, becoming clear near midnight. A low of 14 degrees. And then to finish off the weekend, we've got a sunny Sunday with a high of 23 degrees, except 26 for the inland, for all of us that are inland. Okay. So that was this weekend's forecast brought to you by the Vancouver Weather Bulletin, courtesy of Environment Canada. And up next, we have an interview with Andrew Parr, the Managing Director of Student Housing and Hospitality Services at UBC. News correspondent Morgan Yee spoke with Andrew this Thursday afternoon, last Thursday afternoon, about who gets student housing on campus, how much it costs, and what the university is doing to increase the number of units available to students. We're just going to actually have a quick PSA break, and then we'll get the interview with Morgan Yee and Andrew Parr in just a moment. Stay tuned to CITR 101.9 on News 101. Thank you.
The Vancouver Queer Film Festival is back for its 26th year in theaters August 14 to 24. More than 80 films from 11 countries, including Russia, Brazil, Italy, and the Philippines, showcase themes of gender identity, forbidden love, and culture. Super Pass is available now and tickets on sale July 24. For tickets and more info, check out queerfilmfestival.ca. Support the festival. Donate $10 by texting GIVER10, spelled G-I-V-E-R 10, to 45678.
August issue of Discorder is here. Be sure to pick up a copy around town or check it out online at discorder.ca and catch features on Pat Locke, Dirty Spells, Horses Records, The Beelines, and so much more. Also be sure to peep the Discorder playlist, now available through SoundCloud. And a very special thank you to this issue's advertisers, Audiopile Records, CCEC Credit Union, Catalano Street Party, LiveVan.com, the Ponderosa Festival, the Queer Arts Festival, the Rickshaw Theater, Rifflandia, the Media Club, Vancouver Fetish Weekend, Vancouver Fringe Festival, Vancouver Queer Film Festival, the Victory Square Block Party, and Vinyl Records. Whoever said money can't buy you friends obviously wasn't a member at CITR. When you become a member, you get the Friends of CITR card with incredible discounts in the downtown area at
The Baker and the Chef, Bang On T-shirts, Beat Street Records,
Dunlevy Snack Bar, The Fall Tattooing, Fortune Sound Club, Hits Boutique, Pacific Cinematheque, Perch, The Portside Pub, Save On Meats, and Vinyl Records.
To find out more, visit us in room 233 of the sub on the UBC campus or go online to citr.ca.
And thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So over the last few years, there's been a lot of student concern over the apparent shortage of affordable student housing on UBC's campus. So I guess we should start with what the basics of housing on campus are. In terms of units, how many spaces do we have right now?
We're currently operating 9,400 student spaces, and they range from first-year beds to upper-year facilities, graduate students, and family housing as well in that 9,400. And that is the largest number of beds operated in any university across Canada.
And generally speaking, how much does it cost to run each unit?
Maybe I should talk about how much it costs to rent each unit, because they're pretty much aligned, really. We do actually have a small profit, and we do commit some proceeds back to the core of the university.
Okay.
through the revenues that we generate. But our rental rates range at the low end at about $570 per month, up to townhouse type units for families at around $1,150 per month.
How does that relate to what rental costs are in the Greater Vancouver area?
Yeah, that's a good question. The pricing philosophy that we undertake is we are an ancillary department. We have to cover our costs of operations through the rents that we charge and the revenues we generate from that. But we also push towards an at or below market rental rate, and that's a difficult thing to sort of compare an apples to apples our units to a unit off campus. But we know when we assess our rates against CMHC rates across different communities within the city of Vancouver, that we're equivalent to rental rates that would be the equivalent to a 30 to 40 minute commute for a student from Vancouver. So that really takes us out to East Vancouver and west side of Burnaby. Our rates would compare to rental rates in those areas.
And can you say what the actual profit margin is?
Well, I can tell you we contribute about $4 million to the university on an annual basis.
Okay.
to support other initiatives of the university.
As I understand, first years are guaranteed housing. Have there ever been years where there are more applicants for these units than there are actual units?
Yeah, this year, as a matter of fact. But we do commit to a first-year guarantee for all students that are direct from high school and meet some other criteria, like apply by a certain date and accept an offer by a certain date.
Mm-hmm.
This year, we actually have 550 or so students, first-year students, residing at Gage. Typically, Totem Park and Place Vanier are our first-year residents.
Mm-hmm.
And they're traditional dorm type accommodations with a meal plan and that kind of structure. Gage traditionally has been an upper year residence for second, third, fourth year students. This year we are actually putting, as I said, about 550 first year students into Gage.
Will they be getting a meal plan?
Not a mandatory meal plan, no, because
okay.
We don't really have the facilities for that.
That's
and
correct.
They have kitchens.
Okay.
So we are offering, as we do to all students, but we are offering for first-year students that, and parents of first-year students that want their student to have a meal plan, optional meal plans, but not a mandatory situation.
And I guess that leads very well into the next question. How does UBC handle upper-year student housing?
In two ways, I guess. We have some upper-year winter session housing, which is, contracts from September to April. And students can sort of apply for and enter into what we call the random application process. And a little bit like a lottery, I guess. And we draw on, there's significantly more students that want that kind of accommodation than we have access. So a number of those students end up on wait list. We also have year-round housing. And in our year-round housing environments, that's a 12-month contract. Once you apply for and are offered and accept a year-round contract, you can continue to have a year-round contract on an annual basis without entering into a random application process.
And how many of those units are there?
It's not quite, but it's about 50-50, or sort of half and half, our winter session housing versus our year-round housing.
How many students get turned away for upper-level housing each year?
Well, right now we actually have a wait list, and this is it's at its peak, of course, at this time of year when students are most eager to have housing. But this year our wait list at present is about 5,000 students. That's significant, and we know that that's a huge challenge for many students, not only we not offer housing on campus because we're full with the 9,400 beds are already full, but many of those students are also challenged to find affordable and proximal housing, you know, to UBC. So we recognize that as being a challenge for students.
Are certain groups of students given priority within this pool, like international students or students from out of province?
No, we don't have priority for international or out of province students. There are a few very small priority groups that that the university is prioritizing because of relationships and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So there's a few groups like that, exchange students, for example, but no priorities based on whether you're an international student versus a domestic student or out of province or a British Columbia student.
Okay, and is there specific housing for students with physical disabilities if some of the other housing units aren't necessarily the most accessible?
Again, not so much a priority unless it's sort of supported medically, that a student would be significantly challenged by being off campus versus on campus. If that's medically supported, then we would find a way to accommodate that student on campus. We have a number of accessible units, both sort of physically, you know, accessible. We always have an excess of those number of units to the number of students that actually require them, and then we have those units occupied by able-bodied students as well.
You know, having said that there's no priority for international students, a lot of criticism has come out around the idea that UBC creates student housing that is intended for international students who can pay those premium prices. How do you respond to that?
It's certainly not intentional or strategic to be building residence specifically for international students. We do know that international students that wish to come to UBC also wish to live on campus at a higher ratio than domestic students might, by nature of, you know, local domestic students wanting to live at home or be more familiar with the city outside of UBC and happy to live in those environments. That said, we have about still a significant majority of our students that reside with us are domestic students. It's about last year it was 39% international, 61% domestic.
Okay.
I anticipate that might be a little bit greater this year. It might, you know, jump up 3% to 42 and 58 or something along those lines, but I don't have the actual statistics at this point.
So would you say that increasing the number of students living on campus is a goal of UBC?
Yes.
And what is the university doing to increase the number of students living on campus?
Well, there's the big focus really is actually growing the amount of housing that we offer on campus, student residence housing on campus. So I mentioned earlier that we have 9,400 beds currently. We've added 1,200 beds in the last 3 years, and we're in the process right now. In fact, construction is underway in two different complexes, Ponderosa Commons Phase 2 and the Orchard Commons, which will add another 1,600 beds by 2016. And we have a growth plan actually beyond 2016. They're not approved projects at this point, but a notional plan to actually add another 2,250 beds between 2017 and 2019. I should add there's one other sort of demographic of student that we're seeing wanting to have on-campus student residence housing, and that is from a student demand study we did recently, we found that actually about 60% of the respondents suggested that they would like to live on campus, not just for their first or second year, but for the entire duration of their studies. So that suggests a couple of things. One is we like to think it suggests that they enjoy living on campus and they see the academic and social benefits of it, that we're providing a product that they value. It might also suggest that the marketplace in Vancouver, the rental marketplace in Vancouver, is so challenging that it's, you know, the alternative is just so difficult. But it also then puts more of a demand, a bit more of a burden on us in that more students want to live on campus for longer periods of time, hence opening up fewer spaces for new and incoming students.
Now, moving away from students that are right on campus in the UBC residences, looking at Westbrook Village, is that connected to UBC at all in terms of development, or is that community separate?
It's not connected to student housing and hospitality services, so we have no operational responsibility to that area. UBC Properties Trust is sort of the development arm of UBC that is coordinating the development of those areas. I know there's some market rental housing that is built into that, and we know that some students reside in those locations as well.
Because is there an MBA house?
Yeah, MBA houses is in South Campus in Westbrook Village area.
Okay, but that's not connected to student housing?
We do provide service to that building. It was originally built, not by us, but built by UBC Properties Trust as a student residence. There's a shared partnership arrangement in how we manage that space now.
There was, for a while, and it may still be up, a big banner that said everyone can live at UBC in Westbrook Village. And how realistic do you think that kind of advertising is? And do you feel like it hurts the university's reputation to have private developers creating that kind of expectation?
That's an interesting question. I haven't seen that banner. I guess depending on how one interprets everybody can live at UBC, if it's suggesting that everybody involved in UBC has the ability to live on campus, that would be I would suggest that's probably false advertising at this stage, just because the population is greater than the number of units available. But if it's suggesting that whether you're affiliated with UBC or not, you're welcome to live here, that would be, I would say that's accurate advertising.
Do you think that would put students off to see that? I think there's a lot of discrepancy between the actual separation between Westbrook Village and UBC campus itself,
right,
and then how students understand that difference.
Right. Okay. Yeah, I hear what you're saying. Well, I guess a couple of thoughts. One is that the developments in the surrounding neighborhoods are creating proceeds for the University of British Columbia, and those proceeds are going towards supporting the development of purpose-built student housing. I think there's tremendous value in the creation of the communities that UBC is creating in its surrounding areas and the neighborhoods, just from a vibrant community perspective, but also, again, the financial viability of then being able to invest the proceeds into other things that support student housing and other academic initiatives as well. So I think that's an important thing that students and the public should recognize. The other thing is that we don't actually statistically know, but we do know that students reside in those neighborhoods. So there may be a condominium owner, for example, that is renting the facility out to a student, or there may be a student and a student family that purchased a unit like that for their student to reside in. And there's also rental units that we know students are residing in. It does allow for more on-campus housing than would otherwise be available to students if that kind of development didn't take place.
Related to that, how does the Greek system fit into the UBC housing community?
Again, not something that we're directly responsible for in Student Housing and Hospitality Services. There is oversight through the Vice President's Students Office. There's close to 682 or so units that are specifically dedicated to student housing, but not operated by Student Housing and Hospitality Services. So there's some in the theological neighborhoods, and there's sorority housing and fraternity housing that would be over and above the 9,400 beds that we operate.
I think that's everything, Andrew. Thank you very much.
All right, Morgan, thanks. Yeah.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That's our program for today, August 22nd. Today's newscast was brought to you by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, get involved, or give us an important news tip, contact us through email at news@citr.ca. You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to our latest interviews and segments on our website, citr.ca/news. For more independent news, join us next Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Marco.
And I'm Rohit. Today's show was produced by Valerio Di Feo from the entire news team at CITR. Thank you for listening. Stay tuned. Coming up next is Stranded, right here on CITR 101.9 FM.
Whoever said money can't buy you friends obviously wasn't a member at CITR. When you become a member, you get the Friends of CITR card with incredible discounts on Commercial Drive and other areas at
Bone Rattle Music Limited, High Life Records, People's Co-op Bookstore, Audio Pile Records, Bad Bird Media, Band Merch Canada, Vancouver Music Gallery, and Pandora's Box Rehearsal Studios.
To find out more, visit us in room 233 of the sub on the UBC campus or go online to citr.ca.